Okay, in your Bibles, you can turn to Revelation 16. In your outlines, you need to turn to a page that has the chart on the campaign of Armageddon. What we ended up with is still finishing with the first five of the seven bowl judgments. Now the sixth bowl judgment and the seven bowl judgment deal with stages of the Armageddon campaign. The sixth bowl judgment deals with the first stage, and the seventh bowl judgment deals with the last stage, the eighth stage. So everything between comes from other passages of scripture. I'm going to be spending some time on this. Okay, let's go on the next slide. Some background material. As we said, Messiah's second coming is preconditioned on Israel's national salvation. We pointed out Israel must do two things before Messiah can return. Number one, confess their sin of rejecting him, which they will someday do, and the words they will use is Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. And then secondly, they must plead for the Messiah to return. Plead for the Messiah to return. And so one of the key distinctions between the rapture of the church and the second coming, the rapture is part of God's program for the body, the Messiah, for the church. And it is something that has no preconditions whatsoever. It can happen in a moment of time. But the second coming is part of God's program for Israel. And that's what, and it has a key precondition. The other things you see on the screen we already covered when we talked about chapter 12. That once we understand the precondition of second coming, we understand the theological foundations of anti-Semitism. Satan has had this long war against the Jews throughout Jewish history. And his goal ultimately is for, say, destruction of the Jews before they can plead for Messiah to return. Historically, that's why things like the Crusades occurred. That's why things like the Russian pogroms occurred. That's why the Nazi Holocaust occurred, as we saw previously in this conference. In Revelation 12, once he's confined to the earth, he knows his time is short, and he organizes all of his satanic energies to try to wipe out the Jews once and for all. Now, in the second half of the tribulation, as we saw in Revelation 12, he'll organize a worldwide Nazi-like effort to try to destroy the Jews once and for all. Destroy them before their chance to plead for the Messiah to return. So this part is found in Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9. Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9. That in the persecutions of the second half, two-thirds of the Jewish population will be killed in those persecutions. But one-third is the one-third that will survive, and they become the key element understanding Armageddon, understanding the second coming. Next. Now within the tribulation, there'll be two different political systems, one for each half of the tribulation, and two different distinct religious systems, one for each half. Now, the political system of the first half of the tribulation would be that of 10 kingdoms and 10 kings. There will someday be a total restructuring of the world's borders. We now have over 190 nations. To be restructured, there will be 10 Gentile nations plus Israel. And 10 men will co-equally the world, the first half of the tribulation. That will change in the middle, as we mentioned previously. In the middle of the 7 years, the Antichrist will declare war against all 10 of these kings. In that war, he'll kill 3 of them. The other 7 will submit his authority. And so he will then become the counterfeit King of Kings and the counterfeit Lord of Lords. Now, there'll also be 2 different systems of religion. And the first system of religion we'll discuss later on tonight when we get to Revelation chapter 17, that of the ecclesiastical Babylon. And this one world religion, we'll say more about it a bit later, this one world religion ruled the world religiously for the first half of the tribulation, and believers who will not submit to its authority will suffer persecution, like the fifth seal saints, for example. That will also change at the midpoint. After the Antichrist gains world political authority, he will then destroy this one world religion. As we already also noted, he will sit in the temple, proclaim himself to be God Almighty, and call upon the whole world to worship him as God and to signify their acceptance of his deity by taking his mark of 666. So from the middle to end of the tribulation, one man has ruled the world politically and also religiously. Okay, now some more things by way of introduction. We'll look at some maps that will be involved in Armageddon. Will be the Middle East in general. Next, more specifically, the land of Israel. This is also a broad territory. Next. Now we come to some more specifics. And one important place in this campaign will be the rebuilt city of Babylon. And prophetically, Babylon had to be to rebuild and become the economic and political capital of the world by the Antichrist. Now, before Saddam Hussein was deposed by George Bush, you can say he was bushwhacked. He used a Japanese construction firm. Largely, ancient Babylon has been rebuilt. It was unaffected by either the First and Second Gulf War. His goal was that he'll make that the new capital of Iraq. He saw himself as Nebuchadnezzar II. And just as Nebuchadnezzar I destroyed the biblical land of Israel in Judah, by the same token, he will be the second Nebuchadnezzar that will destroy the modern state of Israel. Well, he didn't get to do that, but the building, the city he's rebuilt, would become the capital of the Antichrist in the future. Next. Another important place in this campaign will be a valley the Christians have come to call the Valley of Armageddon. The Bible never gives that name to that valley. The biblical name of the valley is always the Valley of Jezreel. When you see the term Jezreel, the Valley of Jezreel in Scripture, that is the same valley the Christians called Armageddon. But the word Armageddon is a combination of two words in Hebrew meaning the mountain of Megiddo. And Mount Megiddo sits at the very west side of the valley. On this mount, the city of Megiddo once sat. And that'll play a role in this campaign, but not the role people often have assigned to it. Next. Another important place in this campaign will be the capital of Israel, Jerusalem. Next. And even more specifically will be the old city of Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives on the east, and then the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which is a segment of the Valley of Kidron that separates the Mount of Olives from the Old City Wall. But the most important place in this entire campaign, we'll see in the next slide, a city that is south of the Dead Sea, that's known by its Hebrew name as Bozra, is better known today by its Greek name as Petra. And this we shall see will be the most single important city in this entire campaign. Okay, let's look at Revelation chapter 16 and look at the map in your outline, I mean. And verse 12 says, "The sixth poured out his bowl upon the great river, the river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way might be made ready for the kings who come from the sun rising. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, as it were frogs. For the spirits of demons working signs, which go forth on the kings of the whole world, to gather them together unto war of the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And they gathered them together in a place which is called in Hebrew Har-Mageddon, Har-Megiddo. The campaign begins when the emperor of the world from the city of Babylon, which sits on the Euphrates River, issues this call or this decree to his allied kings. These are the other seven kings that have been under his authority for the previous 3.5 years, to bring their armies together and meet him in a specific locale in the land of Israel. To make it easier for his own army to maneuver, by this point of time, the Euphrates River, which is a large river, will be dried up. And the city of Babylon sits on both banks of the Euphrates. It makes it easier for his own army, which is part of the kings of the east. And again, the eastern scriptures always Mesopotamia, the nearest, not the far east. And so this decree is sent out in verses 13 and 14 from Babylon on the Euphrates. It's the work of the counterfeit trinity. And to make sure the other kings fall into line, demonic spirits go out with this decree to make sure they fall into line. This last war has often been called the Battle of Armageddon, which is a misnomer because it won't be just one battle, but several battles. And so most prophecy teachers today use the term we've been using here, the campaign of Armageddon, but technically that's also a misnomer, because insofar as where the fighting will occur, all the fighting will occur elsewhere. What Armageddon or Valley of Jezreel will be is a place where the armies come together. Well, that's not where the fighting will occur. And this was, when these armies meet here, they'll play a similar role, or the Valley will play a similar role that England played during the Second World War, because Allied forces began to gather their armies together in Britain. But it's not where the final conflict began. It began the beaches of Normandy in France on D-Day. What England was to World War II is what Armageddon or Jezreel will be to this final conflict, where the armies come together. But that's not where the fighting will occur. There is a biblical name for this final war. It's found in verse 14. It calls it the War of the Great Day of God the Almighty. The War of the Great Day of God the Almighty. That's your biblical title for this final conflict. In verse 15, there is a parenthetical statement made that when this decree is issued, the believers of that day can recognize that this marks the final last days or weeks before the second coming will occur. It's a message of comfort to saints living at this point of time. And they decree to gather all these armies in the Jezreel Valley will mark the soon return of the Messiah himself. And finally, the place of the gathering is given in verse 16, called in Hebrew Har-Mageddon or Har-Megiddo, meaning the mountain of Megiddo. So the Antichrist will meet with seven allied kings at Tel-Megiddo at the mount at the west side of the valley. Obviously, the armies themselves are going to need to be spread out in the Valley of Jezreel. Now, this decree that calls these armies together is viewed by Revelation 16, is viewed from a human perspective. From a human viewpoint, it will be the emperor of the world calling his allied kings to bring their armies together and to meet him in a specific locale in the land of Israel. But now let's go to Joel chapter 3, second minor prophet, Joel chapter 3. This gives us God's perspective on these armies coming together. Joel 3, verse 9. Joel 3, verse 9. Proclaim ye this among the nations, prepare war, stir up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears, let the weak say, I am strong. Haste ye and come, all ye nations round about, and gather yourselves together, thither cause your mighty ones to come down, O Jehovah. The God's viewpoint of all these armies coming together is one of mockery. Another passage which we want to look up is Psalm 2, the second psalm. And the second psalm is stated even stronger, as God sees all these armies coming together against him and against his anointed, his Messiah. The one who sits in the heavens will laugh, and the Lord will have them in derision. So while in Psalm 2 he's laughing at them, here in Joel 3 he's mocking them, saying, go ahead and gather yourselves together. Go ahead and take your firearm equipment, turn them into weapons of war. And those of you who are cowardly and weak, pretend that you're strong and courageous. Because while Satan and the Antichrist have their goal for this campaign, which is to annihilate the one-third remnants, the living, God has his own purpose for allowing this to happen. In the course of these events, it'll be God's purpose that will be fulfilled. Okay? So here we have an illustration of the first stage. The Antichrist will take his own army out of Babylon into northern Israel. Next, he'll enter into the Jezreel Valley, the largest of Israel's valleys, the most productive of all the valleys of Israel. Next, and from different parts of the world, these allied kings with their armies will also come together in this large staging area in the valley of Jezreel. Next. Now I'll take certain views. I meant to bring my PowerPoint, but my flash, whatever you call those things, laser point, but I left in the room. But I'm standing on Mount Megiddo right now, on the west side looking towards the northeast. The line of mountains you see towards the left side, those are the hills of Nazareth. This Nazareth marked the northern border of the Jezreel Valley. The city of Nazareth is located in those hills. Next. Eastern border is marked by two things. First of all, Mount Tabor on the left, which is the dome-shaped mountain. And secondly, the more pointy hill on the right, which is called the Hill of Moreh. Next, here's a closer view of Mount Tabor. This has become the traditional Catholic site of the Transfiguration. You might recall as the Messiah was being transfigured, Peter suggested he be allowed to build three tabernacles, one for the Messiah, one for Elijah, one for Moses. He was not allowed to build those three tabernacles, but he did not have to worry, because the Catholic Church has proceeded to build all three tabernacles for Peter. And it originally was built in two separate elements on top of the hill. In the early 1900s, there was a large Catholic church that was built, which incorporated all those three smaller shrines. So this has become their traditional place. The trouble is they picked the wrong mountain. The transfiguration occurred on Mount Hermon, about 45 miles to the northeast from Mount Tabor. And so they picked the wrong mountain. But they have done worse. Next, along with Mount Tabor, the Hill of Moreh marks the eastern border of the Jezreel Valley, and biblically it serves as a twofold witness in God's power of resurrection, because on the south slopes is the town of Shunem, and the town of Shunem is where Elisha raised the son of a woman back to life. On the northern slopes is another town called Nain or Naim, and that's where the Messiah raised a woman's son back to life. So it says that the twofold witness in God's power of resurrection. Next, now we're looking in the southeast, the Hill of Moreh. You see a portion of it on the left. You see in the distance on the right another range of mountains called Mount Gilboa. Next, here's a closer view of the whole Mount Gilboa range, as much larger than what you can see on the screen. No, go back. Go back. Go forward. There it is. And what's famous about Mount Gilboa, that's where Saul and his three sons were killed by the Philistines, that set the stage of the kingdom of David to be established. So along with Mount Gilboa, next, the hills of Samaria, in the distance, in the haze, serve as the southern border of the Jezreel Valley. All these shots were taken from the west side from the Mount Megiddo. Now we're going to cross to the east side. Next. Now I'm standing on Mount Tabor, looking towards the west. And on the right, you'll see again the northern border, which is the hills of Nazareth. But in the shade, you can not in the shade, but in the midst, in the haze. On the far left, you'll see another mountain range called Mount Carmel. And Mount Carmel marks the western border of the Jezreel Valley. Next. Here's part of the Mount Carmel range. That's where Elijah's famous contest with the prophets of Baal. And when they could not prove the Baal's God, they were all taken down to the river Kishon and were slaughtered. And you see the river in front of you, it flows towards the hills and finally empties into the Mediterranean. As the river got closer to the mountains, that would be around that area that the prophets of Baal were slain. Next. And here is Armageddon. Here is Mount Megiddo. And it got at the Megiddo Pass. There were 7 entrances into this important Jezreel Valley, and this got at the most important pass called the Megiddo Pass. And either Christ will meet with 7 allied kings here at this mountain, but obviously the armies would be spread out in front of it beyond. All right, let's go on to the second stage and turn to Isaiah chapter 13. The second stage will be the destruction of Babylon. Destruction of Babylon. There are five chapters that give us the details. And we'll look at two of these now. The first one will be Isaiah chapters 13 and 14. Isaiah 13 and 14. And then Jeremiah 50 and 51. Jeremiah 50 and 51. And the fifth chapter is Revelation 18, which we'll get to in our discussion later on tonight. Now, chapter 13, verse 1, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, son of Amos, did see. Set ye up an ensign upon the bare mountain, lift up the voice unto them, wave the hand, they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, yea, I have called my mighty men from an anger, even my proudly exulting ones. The noise of a multitude in the mountains is of a great people, the noise of a tumult of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together. Jehovah's host is mustering the host for the battle. They come from far country, from the uttermost part of heaven, even Jehovah, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. What Isaiah sees is armies gathering together, but these are anti-Babylon armies or anti-Antichrist armies. And they're gathering for the express purpose of destroying the city of Babylon. Now, the rest of chapter 13 and also chapter 14 through verse 23. 14:23 provides the details of how Babylon will be destroyed. This has never happened historically, never fulfilled in the course of history. It is yet a future event. Furthermore, in verse 6, and in verse 9, he mentions the timing of this. The timing of this is during the day of Jehovah, the day of the Lord. That's the most common biblical term in both testaments, for we now call it the tribulation. Our most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation, but the most common biblical term is the day of Jehovah, the day of the Lord. That's the timing of these events. And furthermore, in verse 3, notice, the commission is given to God's consecrated ones or God's sainted ones. Kind of keep that in mind. We'll come back to that a bit later. And then we have the details that were simply not fulfilled in Babylon's history, but will be fulfilled in the prophecy of Babylon. By the way, the day of the Lord in every context is used as a time of divine judgment, and in most passages, a time of the judgment just before the setting up of the kingdom, just before the Messianic kingdom is set up. So in the midst of this judgment of Babylon in chapter 14, verse 1 and 2, 14, 1 and 2, he describes Israel's final restoration. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 50. Jeremiah chapter 50. We'll begin with verse 9, chapter 50, verse 9. For Lo, I will stir up and cause to come up against Babylon a company of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From thence she shall be taken, their arrow shall be an expert mighty man, and none shall return in vain. And Chaldea shall be a prey. All that prey upon her shall be satisfied, says Jehovah. Now skip over to verse 41, chapter 50, verse 41. Behold, a people come from the north, and a great nation, and many kings shall be stirred up from the uttermost parts of the earth. They lay hold on bow and spear, they are cruel and have no mercy. The wars roar like the sea, and ride upon horses, everyone set in array as a man to the battle against you, O daughter of Babylon. What Jeremiah sees is what Isaiah saw more than a century and a half previously. Groups of armies coming together. But they're coming together for the express purpose of destroying the city of Babylon. As we'll see in Revelation 18, when they attack and destroy Babylon, they will do it suddenly and quickly and massively. And before anyone knows what's happening, Babylon, the capital of the world, is burning and burning away. What's important about Jeremiah's passage is that he indicates that a king is not in the city when these things occur. So in verse 43, we read, the king of Babylon had heard the tidings of them. His hands waxed feeble. Anguish had taken hold of him, and pangs as a woman in travail. Now with this, skip over to chapter 51 and verse 31. Chapter 51 and verse 31. One post shall run to meet another, and one messenger to meet another, to tell the king of Babylon the city is taken every quarter, and the passages are seized. The reason they are burned with fire, the men of war are frightened. The fact that messengers must be sent out to inform the king of Babylon that his city has been destroyed by fire is the indication that he's not within the city when these things will occur, otherwise there's no need to tell him. So where would he be? By comparing the passages of the first stage with these of the second stage, while the Antichrist is meeting his own allies in Israel, and having removed his own army out of Babylon, his enemies, those of the consecrated ones of Isaiah 13:3, used this time to gather together and destroy the city. And again, Revelation 18, we'll notice later tonight, they'll destroy it quickly, suddenly, and massively. And now the world economic and political capital has been destroyed. This brings on stage three. Let's go to, before that, let's go to the next map. Here you see the second stage. While the Antichrist meeting with allied kings in Israel, his enemies take the opportunity to destroy his capital city. Normally what we have at this point is pictures of Babylon, where it's been rebuilt and destined to become a world capital. However, if you look at the border around Babylon, Babylon is inside the Arab country of Iraq. An Arab country of Iraq does not like 5'4" Jewish kids running around the country taking pictures of it. So for this reason, I don't have those pictures for you just yet. But maybe after the next Arab-Israeli war, I can get those for you. So we'll move on to stage three, and let's go to Zechariah chapter 12. You would think, having received a message from those runners that the city has been destroyed, you want to go east to destroy his enemies. But it's not so much that the Antichrist is here in control, but the Satan is in control. And Satan's goal is not to save the Antichrist, but to save himself. And to save himself, he must destroy the Jews. So instead of moving the armies east, the armies are going to be moving south. And the third stage will be the attack and the fall of Jerusalem. Look at Zechariah 12, verse 2. 12:2, behold, I will make Jerusalem a copper reeling unto all the peoples round about. and upon Judah also shall it be in the siege against Jerusalem. It shall come to pass in that day, I'll make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the peoples, although all those who burdensome with it shall be sorely wounded. And then notice, and I shall gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Now skip over to chapter 14 and verse 1. Chapter 14, verse 1. Behold, a day of Jehovah comes when your spoils shall be devoured in the midst of you, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, the houses rightful and ravished, half the city shall go forth into captivity, but the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. The Antichrist will move south, and he attacked the city, and the attack will be followed by a rather heavy bit of fighting described in two passages. So for your notes, this is Micah chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. Micah chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. And also Zechariah chapter 12, verses 4 through 9. Chapter 12, verses 4 through 9 of Zechariah. Both passages describe a similar situation, that God's going to energize the Jewish defenders, so that the weak ones among the Jews will fight like the angel of Jehovah David's among the Jews will fight like the angel of Jehovah, causing tremendous decimation in the ranks of the enemy. Nevertheless, because of superiority in number, Jerusalem will fall. And in Micah 5:1, the judge of Israel will be smitten with a rod upon his cheek, the angel symbol of defeat and surrender. Once again, the city will be trampled down by Gentile armies. Okay, let's go to, there's two main ways to get to Jerusalem from the Valley of Jezreel. One is the longer coastal route, easier route, but there's also a shorter route, but a bit more treacherous route in the central mountain range. The Bible doesn't specify which way he goes. He may go one way, or he may go the other, or he may do what Sennacherib does in Isaiah 10. In that the Assyrian army was gathered in Armageddon, then he split the army in two, sending half one way, half the other way. Whichever way they get there, one thing that Zechariah makes clear twice over, all the armies of all the countries is going to gather together and attack the city of Jerusalem. And after some heavy fighting, it will finally fall. Moving on to some of the pictures, we'll first see some views of the old city, which has been part of Israel since 1967, then the new city since 1948. Here you're looking at the old city from the top of Mount Scopus. Next. Here you see the city from the top of the Mount of Olives. Now, between the eastern wall and where I'm standing on top of the Mount of Olives is nothing but graves, nothing but tombs. The graves against the wall are Muslim graves. The graves inside the valley are Christian graves. By Christian, I mean Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox primarily. And from the bottom of the valley all the way to the top of the Mount of Olives are Jewish tombs. So Muslim, Christian, Jewish tombs. But the Jewish tombs have something that the Muslim tombs don't have and the Christian tombs don't have. Inside every Jewish tomb, there is a light inside. An Israelite. Got to keep you awake somehow. Next. Here's see the southeast corner of the temple compound wall. It was always the highest point from top to bottom. It's known as the pinnacle of the temple. It's in that corner when the three temptations of the Messiah occurred. Next. Here you see some more of the wall. Most of what you see today doesn't go back to biblical times. Certain parts do, but most of it does not. Most of it was built by the Turks after 1517 AD, in the 1500s. And most of it was built by one particular Turkish sultan who humbly called himself Suleiman the Magnificent. Next. You see the temple compound from the Garden of Gethsemane. Next. You see some of the housetops of the old city. On the horizon, you see on the left side with the pillar, Mount Scopus. In the middle is the Mount of Olives. Next. This is known as the Western Wall among Jewish people. Gentiles are referred to as the Wailing Wall. And that was what remains of the outer western compound wall of the temple compound. It's not the wall of any building of the temple compound. It served as the outer compound fence wall. And the lower high big stones are from the Herodian period, the first century. And what you see above the ground is just a few of those, but it goes about 16, 17 more reams like that below the ground level. Next. Now you're on top of the temple compound, and where the Dome of the Rock stands, that's the top of Mount Moriah. In the view of most historians and archaeologists, that's where the Second Temple stood. There's a minority view that the Holy of Holies of the Second Temple stood in the smaller archway, where you see on the right-hand side. Neither of you can prove it until they can dig in this area, but because it's under Islamic control, because Israel recognizes religious control of religious sites, and therefore gave the Muslims control of this. It's not Israeli sovereignty, but the religious section is controlled by the religion, in this case, the religion of Islam. And they won't allow the Jews to do any archaeological dig to verify exactly where the temple was or was not. Next. Now go to a new city, which has been part of Israel since 1948. Next. There's a mixture of the old and the new. On the hill, you can see the modern Israeli condominiums where Jewish people live. But in the valley is a monastery that was built in the 6th century. It's called the Monastery of the Cross. And why did they call it the Monastery of the Cross? Because 6 centuries after the fact, it was built on the exact site where the tree grew from which the cross of Jesus was made. And if you believe that one, they'll tell you another one. Next. It's a well-kept city, but it's very expensive to live in this city. Next. It'll be very hard to find a decent house, not even a house, just a little apartment, for less than $500,000. Very difficult. Next. In these, they're much more exclusive, and to get into one of those apartments or condominiums is about $2 million. It's not a cheap city to live in. Next. On the left side, you see the seat of the two chief rabbis of Israel, so it's almost like a Jewish Vatican. And the right-hand side, you see the chief synagogue of Jerusalem. Every Jewish city, like Tel Aviv, Haifa, elsewhere, has many synagogues, but one chief synagogue. The chief rabbi for that city who functions there, and this is the chief synagogue for the city of Jerusalem. Next. This is the Knesset building, the Israeli parliament building. This is where the government meets and makes its various decisions, and so on. So it's a very important structure in the city of Jerusalem. Now we need to deviate a bit, and turn your Bibles to Micah, Chapter 2. We covered the first 3 stages. Now we're going to deviate a bit to tie some loose ends together from the bigger prophetic picture. As we already noted in Revelation 12, that from the military tribulation, the Jews are fleeing the land. So at this point of time, most Jews are no longer in the land. There's still Jews left here, like in Jerusalem and so on. But most Jews are no longer in the land. They fled to a specific place. We saw 2 clues so far in Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 and 16. Matthew 24, 15 and 16, they fled to the mountains. We saw Revelation chapter 6, chapter 12, verse 6. Revelation 12, 6, they flee into the wilderness territory. But no specific spot has been given. It is Micah chapter 2 that provides us with the exact spot. There could be a small difficulty with certain renderings, certain translations. But let me show you the mistake that was made by some renderings. Micah's book is divided into three prophetic messages. Each prophetic message begins with the "Hear ye." So chapters 1 and chapter 2 is one unit, one prophetic discourse God gave the prophet. And what you have in verses 10 through 16 of chapter 1, 10 through 16 is a lot of workplace. You don't see these workplace in English, but workplace can't translate well. But if you know Hebrew, even just basic Hebrew, you can see the wordplay. So example in verse 10, tell it not in Gath. The pronunciation in Hebrew of tell and also of Gath is the same root. So the wordplay is tell it not in Teltown. And then it goes on to saying, at Beit La'afra, have wrote myself in the dust. These are real names of real towns, but they all have meanings in Hebrew. So Beit La'afra means the house of dust. The house of dust. So it's the wordplay here, and I will roll myself in the dust in Dust City. And then in verse 11, pass away inhabitants of Shafir in nakedness and shame. Shafir means beauty, a beauty town. The Jewish name Shapira comes from this word. And he points out that beauty town will be disbeautified. So all of these names you have all the way down to verse 16, these are workplace. When it comes to chapter 2, verse 12, which many translations have missed, is he makes one more workplay. Now I'm reading from the ASV, American Standard Version, which is correct. King James is also correct. But some of the other renderings like ESV or NASB have chosen to translate the name of the town rather than noticing the wordplay. So look at verse 12. I'll surely assemble, O Jacob, all of you. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together with the sheep of Bozrah. That's the name you have missing. You might not have the word sheepfold, because that's what Bozrah means, a sheepfold. As a flock in the midst of the pasture, they shall make great noise by the reason of men. But the place he says he will gather the remnant of Israel, the Jews who survived the persecution and so on, is the city of Bozrah, which means a sheepfold. And it's better known by its modern name as Petra. And you can see the reason for the name, because what was an ancient sheepfold like? There was walls on all sides, but there was a passageway, which was narrow. And the shepherd would count his sheep one by one as they get in to make sure none were wandered off. And the city of Petra is shaped like a gigantic sheepfold, as we shall see in the slides, a passageway going in, the largest surrounding area that people can maneuver around. And so that is the position of the city. So it's a real city, but shaped like a big sheepfold. And in the sheepfold, God will gather his Jewish sheep that survived the tribulation. Now, why would they flee here? One clue is given to us in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. Now, Daniel chapter 11, verses 36 to 45. Daniel 11, 36 to 35 describes the wars and the middle tribulation as the Antichrist begins to gain full control. The three kings he kills are all enumerated in this context. What we're concerned is what he says in verse 41. Chapter 11, verse 41. He will also enter into the glorious land. This would be Israel. And many nations shall be overthrown, but these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. There's always been a principle in Jewish history, the one part of the world turns against the Jews, God always makes sure another part of the world is a place they can flee to. One of the more important years in Jewish history is the year 1492. That was the year that Columbus discovered the New World, and soon became a haven for Jewish refugees fleeing much persecution in Europe. God's a principle. God always makes a way for the Jews to escape to. Now, the Antichrist will gain the whole world. He'll rule the whole world. Nevertheless, he points out three countries escape his domination: Edom, Moab, and Ammon. All three of these ancient countries make up one country today, and that is Jordan. The modern-day kingdom of the Jordan comprises all three nations. The location of Bozrah, or Petra, is now within the border of southern Jordan. Southern Jordan is ancient Edom. And that's part of what will escape the rule of the Antichrist. So with the whole world under the Antichrist, the only way to place the Jews can escape the land is to go east into what's now called Jordan and move south to the ancient territory of Edom. And there hide for the remaining 3.5 years. And that'll be the city of refuge in the tribulation. Okay, now let's look at some pictures. So there's Petra. From the middle of the tribulation onward, that's where much of the Jews will flee. Not all of them will be there. The leadership will be there. Many of the residents will be there. Most will be Jews fleeing to Assyria and Jews fleeing to Egypt. Next. To be the right city, it must fulfill 3 requirements. It must be in desert territory. We're outside the city here. And you see the surrounding territory. This is desert territory. In scripture, it's called the wilderness of the land of Edom. Next. We're still outside the city, and this is the range of mountains the Bible calls Mount Seir. It's in this mountain range of Mount Seir that the city of Petra is located. It now fulfills the 2nd requirement. Third, next slide. The 3rd requirement is must be a pre-existing place. A pre-existing place. Next several slides will illustrate this. Only one way to get into this city, and that is to a narrow passageway that begins right here. And as you keep walking, it'll be about 1.25 miles or 1.5 miles of walking before you get inside the city. The passage gets narrower, and the walls on 2 sides get much higher. Next. Here's about the halfway point. Notice the narrowness and the heights of it. Next. There you can see people riding on horses. Gives you a sense of perspective. Next is one of the Arab guides who come riding on his horse. But notice how tiny he looks compared to the size of the walls. Next. As you walk, you always come through this passageway. We've now tossed the end of it. Next. Now inside the city, looking back at the passageway. 2 ancient groups inhabited the city. First were the Nabataeans, and then came the Romans. But even if you never had any archaeology, you can tell by looking what are Nabataean remains and what are Roman remains. Rome built like everybody else built back then, stone upon stone, rock upon rock. The Nabataeans did not like to do it that way. They would go to the edge of a cliff like you see on both sides of the passageway and simply chisel out 1 building from the side. Next. Here's one of many examples. Look at the bottom. You see an Arab man with his keffiyeh sitting by the stairwell. See how small he is compared to that big structure? And now the whole structure is only 1 piece of rock was simply chiseled out. Those pillars are never freestanding pillars. They're simply chiseled out by the side of the cliff just that way. That's why the Greeks called the city Petra. Petra means a massive cliff rock. And the city is comprised of buildings made of massive cliff rocks. Next. As you go in, yourself comes into a large, wider circle area, which describes the Hebrew name of Batsra, a sheepfold. Next. Everywhere you walk, you'll be surrounded by these cliff rocks. The only way to get in is through that narrow gorge. Next. Next. There's lots of ground for growing food. There's lots of water available, but nobody's living in the city today. It's waiting to become a Jewish neighborhood. Next. Everywhere you walk, you'll come to these large buildings carved from the side of the cliff. Next. Here's your Nabataean version of a condominium. You can see an Arab man with his keffiyeh walking down one of these archways. Again, that gives you a sense of proportion, how small he is compared to the structure. Next. Those big buildings were for the wealthy class, but even the poorer class lived in housing, but they lived in this tenement-type housing, but also carved out the sides of the cliff. Next. Everywhere you walk or ride a mule or ride a horse, you'll be confronted by these huge top, large buildings. Next. Notice again a very large building. It's all 1 piece of rock, but in the doorway, notice somebody sitting by the doorway. Again, notice how small people are compared to the size of the structure. Next. It's made up largely of soft sandstones. You find funny some of these caves are colored by these multicolored layers. Next. Otherwise, all you're surrounded by is these cliff rocks. Next. Here's the main street during its Roman occupation. Next. You can see the stone upon stone by the pillars on the side of the ancient highway. Next. Also the main gate leading to the highway. Next. Well, the highway itself is Roman. It dead ends at Napatine Ravines against the cliff. Next. This is the amphitheater, which will comfortably seat 3,000 people. I can visualize the Jewish elders meeting there to finally asking the question, why have we suffered these things? Finally, they find the answer and begin to plead for the Messiah to return. Next. And this was the Roman administration building and temple building during its Roman administration, the building. So the city will become the city of refuge during the second half of the tribulation. This brings on the fourth stage. Next. And the fourth stage is given in Jeremiah 49, verses 13 to 14. Because the goal is to annihilate the Jews, and since the bulk of them are in this Petra city, the armies will now move against the Jews of Petra to try to annihilate them. As this event that brings on the fifth stage. The armies come from Jerusalem against the Jews of Petra. Next. Next. The fifth stage will be the national salvation of Israel. Next. And again, they must do two things, confess their national sin and plead for the Messiah to return, which is what they will do at this point of time. Next. So before Israel can enjoy the full benefits of the Abrahamic covenant in Leviticus 26, they must first confess the sin of their fathers and their sin before they can see the full fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, especially as it pertains to the borders of the promised land. In Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 12 through 18, because before Israel can enjoy the full benefits of the Messianic kingdom, they must confess an iniquity, so in the singular. There's one specific sin that has to be confessed before they can enjoy the benefits of the kingdom. Next. Zechariah 12:10 is key. And the Spirit will be poured out upon the nation, and they'll begin to mourn for the one that they have previously pierced. They'll mourn for him as one mourns for only son. And when they begin that period of mourning, that will lead to the removal of Israel's sins in Zechariah 13. And Zechariah 14, it will involve the second coming of the Messianic kingdom. But both those are preconditioned by chapter 12, verse 10. Israel must first look unto the one they pierced and plead for him to return. Next. Matthew 23:37-39. In verse 37, he summarizes his three-year ministry, hoping long to spread his hands out and give the city the messianic protection printed by the prophets, but says, ye would not. Literally in Greek, you wilted not when they rejected him. So in verse 38, their house, the temple, will lie desolate. It'll be destroyed 40 years after he speaks these words. But then notice verse 39, he says to them, you will not see me henceforth until you shall say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. In the Jewish context, that was the official messianic greeting. Rabbis were teaching, whenever the Messiah comes, he needs to be welcomed with those words, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And they will not say this of him till they accepted him as the Messiah. So both Old and New Testament provide the same precondition to the second coming. It must be the Israel's salvation and Israel's confession before they can see him return. Next. A key passage, Isaiah 5:15. God is speaking, and God says he's going to he's going to return to where he came from. He came from heaven, and I'll return to heaven. And there he will stay until they confess their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. And so in this passage is that the offense committed against the Messiah was in rejecting his messianic claims on the grounds of being demonized. So he left the earth and says, you will not see me henceforth until you confess that offense. And so again, until they confess their offense, there'll be no second coming. Next. The response of Hosea chapter 6, verses 1, 2, and 3 is the response of 5:15. And the leaders will finally recognize what they need to do, and they'll issue the decree of the first three verses of Hosea, calling the nation to national repentance. And when that decree is issued, that will trigger the last 3 days before the second coming. For the first two of these last 3 days, they'll confess the national sin, rejecting his messiahship. And then on the third day, the whole nation will come to faith. And then they will plead for the Messiah to return, so Israel's physical restoration can occur. Next. Come see key passages I won't detail. Isaiah 64. Next. Psalm 79 and also Psalm 80. You see the words that they will use to plead for Messiah to return. So with Israel's national salvation, will the second coming occur? Okay, we come to the sixth stage, which is the actual second coming of the Messiah. Initial place of his return will be at the city of Bozra or Petra, as we shall see. So here's the map of it. The Jewish request him to do so will have the second coming. Next. Here's our two key passages. And in verses 1, 2, and 3, so he says, God has wrath and indignation against all the nations, but more specifically, he says, against all their armies. And the sword of God is about to strike all the armies of all the nations. But when he strikes them, where in the world will he strike them? He first of all gives the country in verse 5. He'll strike them in the land of Edom, today that's southern Jordan. In verse 6 and 7, it's more specific. He strikes them in the city of Bozra, modern-day Petra. Let's look at this another passage because that's a bit more graphic. Let's go to Isaiah 63. In this passage, Isaiah is standing along the mountain ranges of Israel, looking towards the southeast, and he sees a graphic, glorified figure approaching him. And a question-answer session ensues between Isaiah the prophet and this individual. Two questions are going to be raised, and two questions are answered. First question is in verse 1. Who is this that comes from Edom, with dyed garments from Bozra, this who is glorious in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength? And the answer is, I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Only one person can fit this description, who marches in the greatness of his power, whose very clothing has been glorified by the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory. Only one person can make the claim that this one makes, and that is none other than the Messiah, who speaks in righteousness with full ability to save. He's now returning to Israel, but notice where he's coming to Israel from. The land is Edom or southern Jordan, the city is Bozra or Petra. In the vision, as the figure approaches the prophet closer, the prophet notices something else. Although his garments have been glorified by the Shekinah glory, he's also been stained with blood. And that raises a second question in verse 2. Wherefore are you red in your apparel, and your garments like him that threaded the wine vat? And there comes the answer in verse 3. I have trodden the wineplass alone, of the peoples there was no man with me. Yea, I trod them down in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and the lifeblood is sprinkled upon my garments, I have stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered, there was none to uphold. Therefore, my own arm brought salvation unto me, and my wrath upheld me. And I trod down the peoples in mine anger and trampled them and made drunk in my wrath, and I poured out the lifeblood on the earth. The reason for his garments becoming bloodstained is because it's coming from a magnificent conflict. In the course of the conflict, you have to trample the enemy. In the course of trampling the enemy, the lifeblood spilled over and stained his garments. But where did the fighting occur? The land is Edom, southern Jordan, and the city is Bozrah Petra, and that will be the initial place of that return. Next. Another passage, Micah 3:3, he comes from Teman and Mount Param. As you're walking towards Jerusalem from Petra, you go by these ancient sites of Teman and Mount Param. Micah 2:12 and 13, the remnant of Israel will be gathered in Bozrah. After the siege, will be led by Jehovah their king. And in Judges 4 and 5, God is seen as coming from Mount Seir. And Mount Seir is in the land of Edom. It's the main mountain range. And that's the biblical name for that mountain range. Next. They'll bring on the seventh stage, the battle from Bozrah to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And this marks the seventh stage. Next. A key passage here is Joel chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. The battle from Bozrah until the Valley of Jehoshaphat will occur as the same thing we saw in the winepress of Revelation 14, verses 17 to 20. And the 200-mile extension where the blood flows is from the Valley of Jehoshaphat down to what is now Eilat or Aqaba. Next. And here's the map. It'll work its way back towards Jerusalem. Next. And finally end in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Next. The Valley of Jehoshaphat starts out as rather wide. It's on the east side is the city of Jerusalem, and the west side the Mount of Olives. Next. As you keep on walking, it'll get narrower and quite a bit drier. Next. Here you see less and less of the trees. Next. Here you see more of the dryness, except for the trees planted by the Israeli authorities. Next. It finally narrows down to the winding valley and empties into the Dead Sea. There will come the eighth stage. The victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. Next. Zechariah 14, verses 3 and 4, that in verse 3, God first of all goes out, the Messiah first of all goes out and fights against all those armies of all the nations. Only when the fighting is over does his feet stand upon the Mount of Olives. Next. If the Mount of Olives will be split into two parts by a tremendous earthquake in verses 4 and 5, and so there'll be a valley running east and west, which will provide escape. There's still Jews in Jerusalem, remember, from the Zechariah passage. And with this tremendous earthquake destroying the city, this Mount of Olives being split and given the Jews in the city a flat land to escape through this new pass that will be created by the earthquake of the Second Coming. Next. And then you can see in this map, the victory is sent up upon the Mount of Olives. Next. The Mount of Olives is, in English, is not really saying what it is. It's actually a small mountain range containing three different mounts, with the central mount here having become the most dominant. And it's also somewhat cluttered with churches. There wasn't much that Jesus could do without somebody come later to build a church over the spot. The church on the left side in the ground level, That's the church marked over the spot with the disciples left behind to watch the gate. Go halfway up, you'll see another church. That's the Russian Orthodox Church. There's the official names for these churches. Over the years, I've given them my own names. The official name of that church is the Church of Mary Magdalene. I call it the Church of the Onion Heads, which you can see from the top over there. To the right of it, you'll see a small black domed chapel. That's where Jesus supposedly wept over Jerusalem. Next. The most dominant church, also Russian Orthodox, is the one you see on top, built right on the summit of the Mount of Olives, and it's called the Church of the Ascension, because they just assumed that he would have ascended from this highest point. But then Luke chapter 24 specifies that he ascended while he was by the town of Bethany. The town of Bethany is about a mile and a half away from the summit and the lower eastern slopes of the Mount of Olives. So they missed this one by about a mile and a half. But if you go, they'll even show you a slab of stone with the footprints embedded into it. Because when the Messiah blasted off, he burned these footprints into this rock. And that's the evidence that that's where the ascension occurred. Next. There's again the Church of the Onion Heads. If you move in our direction, they even built a church over the spot where the rooster crowed when Peter denied Jesus three times. The official name of that church is the Church of Peter of Gallicunta. I call it the Church of the Cock-a-Doodle-Doo. Next. You see the Mount of Olives and Temple compound area. In the tours that led to Israel over these many decades, when we finally got to the Sea of Galilee, I always praised the Lord, the Sea of Galilee was too big to build a church over. Because if they could have, they would have. Next. And here's a survey of all eight stages. Stage one, the assembling of the allies of the Antichrist in Jezreel. Stage two, the destruction of Babylon. Stage three, the attack and fall of Jerusalem. Stage four, the armies of the Antichrist come down to Bozrah or Petra. Stage five will be Israel's national salvation. Stage six, the second coming. Stage seven, the conflict from there back to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And stage eight, the victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. Now we'll go back to our Revelation passage and look at Revelation 16. And now we come to the seven bowl judgment in verses 17 through 21. And the seven bowl brings to an end the wrath of God in verse 17. And remember back in chapter 11, that's what he said would be true of the seventh trumpet, but now it's true with the last bowl judgments, which again shows that just like the seventh seal contained the seven trumpet judgments, the seventh trumpet contains the seven bowl judgments. And this, and in verses 18 and 19, you see again convulsions of nations, a great earthquake, causing Jerusalem to be divided into three parts, which required the rebuilding of the city for the Messianic kingdom. And the city of Babylon will now suffer fully the wrath of God, which will be detailed in chapter 18. In verse 20, there'll be major geographical changes around the world. So there are some things that remain the same, but many things would be rather different. And tomorrow we'll see some elements of the differential that's going to make. And it finally concludes with hail falling. And each hailstone in verse 21 is 120 pounds weight. Now as we come to chapter 17 and 18, we follow the law recurrence that we mentioned in the first night. A law recurrence now goes back to earlier parts of the events that were described earlier to provide more details. And the recurrence deals with the two Babylons. And the first Babylon is the religious Babylon, ecclesiastical Babylon, in chapter 17. And that provides some more information about the first half of the tribulation. So verses 1 through 6, we have the religious system of the first half. What it says in verse 1 is a great harlot, a great prostitute. Now as a verb, to prostitute something is to take something that has illegitimate use, but then use it in an illegitimate way. So in the physical world, that's what a prostitute does with sexual relations. Sex has a proper place in the marriage, but she uses it in the proper way. She prostitutes something that has legitimate use. The same principle applies spiritually. You find this frequently in the Hebrew Bible, where you talk about spiritual adultery, spiritual elements, especially when Israel fell into idolatry. And this hall is doing that with religion. Now, religion does have a valid place. That's in James chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. James 1, 26 and 27. And a true religion is one that takes care of widows and orphans and remains unspotted from the world. But when religion goes from a role of service or servanthood to a position of rulership, then the religion has been prostituted. That's what happens here. Because we learn here that she sits upon many waters. He interprets the many waters later in verse 15 as being the world population. So she sits upon many waters, rules over the world population, not in the sense of serving, but the sense of ruling, and that's how religion has become prostituted. In verse 2, the fornication is committed with the kings of the earth, the other seven kings. And so there is the unity of religion and state, supported in verse 3 by civil government. In verses 4 and 5, he provides to us a description and an identification. And so we have the full name, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the Mother of Harlots, and the Abominations of the Earth. Now, the word mystery, again, whenever you see that term, it doesn't carry the same meaning in English that it does in the Greek. The Greek New Testament always refers to something totally unknown in the Hebrew Bible, revealed for the first time in the pages of the New Testament. But how is Babylon the mother of harlots, meaning the mother of all false religions? Turn now to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10. In Genesis chapter 10, what Moses does is provide us with a list of the 70 different nations arising from the three sons of Noah. And mostly it's just this one begat that one and so on. But now and then he makes some side comments, and he does so with a man named Nimrod. And we pick up in verse 8, chapter 10, verse 8, then Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Jehovah, wherefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Jehovah. And the beginning of his kingdom was by Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. Out of that land he went forth into Assyria, and he built at Nineveh, and Rehoboth-ir, and Calah, and Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, the same as the great city. And Nimrod, contrary to what was instructed, and in a way a covenant to multiply and spread out, he wanted to stay, keep people together and be the ruler over them. You have here the beginnings of the Babylon Empire. In English it says Babel, but in Hebrew Babel and Babylon is the same word, so I'm not sure why in English they made that differentiation. And so he broke away from the account of the Noahic covenant and wished to keep everybody together. He began by building the city of Babel, which is Babylon. Now, for reasons we're not told why at this stage, he moved north and went into Assyria, and there he built Nineveh. Why did he make the move? It doesn't tell us here, but he made the move because of chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. Because while he was still in Babylon, he began to build the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel was for the purpose of astrological worship, with astrological designations. Here you have the first mention of a false religion in biblical history. And that's how Babylon became the mother of all false religions. That's where false religion began, and that's where that will also end. So going back to Revelation chapter 17, that's why Babylon is called the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth. He's described as being wealthy and influential. Here we have the final form of Jezebel of chapter 2 of Revelation, and then also the final form of the Laodicean church, the unbelieving church. And this becomes the counterfeit bride of Messiah. And back in chapter 6, we talked about the fifth seal saints. Two questions were raised. First of all, how did they receive the gospel? That was answered in chapter 7 by means of the 144,000 Jews. Second question is who is responsible for martyring them? And here we find out it was this world religion. Because in verse 6, she is guilty of the persecution of the saints of the first half of the tribulation. She's drunk with the blood of the martyrs. And now we see who's responsible for martyring the fifth seal saints. What happens in verses 7 through 14, I will not detail this whole discussion on the times of Gentiles that could not be fit into the course that we're doing this week. But we'll skip down now over to verse 12. He points out that 10 horns represent the 10 kings who are contemporary with the Antichrist. And in verse 13, notice they hand over their authority to the Antichrist. And the fourth beast is ultimately defeated, notice in verse 14, by the coming of the Messiah. In verse 15, he interprets the many waters, human population around the world. But in verses 16 and 17, we see the destruction of this religious Babylon. Because once the Antichrist takes over the political sphere of the world, and all the other kings submit his authority, then together they will destroy this one world religion. And when they destroy this one world religion, that opens the way for what he was described as doing back in chapters 12 and 13, taking over the Jewish temple and proclaiming himself to be God Almighty and calling upon the whole world to worship him as king. What you have in verse 18 is the transition from Babylon the religion to Babylon the city, because the city where the world religion will be headquartered will be the city of Babylon. So moving on to chapter 18, this is going to be the last chapter we'll survey. We'll finish the book tomorrow. Here we have political Babylon, which will be the literal city of Babylon that will serve as the economic and political capital of the world. So in verses 1, 2, and 3, you have a declaration of the fall of Babylon. And in verse 1 and 2, become the habitation of demons. And in the Messianic kingdom, as we shall see tomorrow, the Satan will be confined in the abyss. But the demons will not be there with him. They'll be confined in two other localities. And one of these localities will be the city of Babylon, which at this point becomes burning pitch and burning brimstone. The second place would be Edom or Sodom and Jordan, also have burning pitch and burning brimstone. And the basis of the judgment is in verse 3, for political corruption, the kings, and for economic corruption, the merchants. Instead, there's a call to the Jews in verses 4 and 5 to flee the city before its final destruction. And then in verses 6 to 8, you have the indictment against Babylon. In verse 6, she is guilty, requiring double vengeance, double punishment, because in verse 7, she vaunted herself against the true God. So in verse 8, she'll suffer now swift and sudden destruction. And verses 9 to 19 go on to give us the lamentations and lamenters of the fall of Babylon. In verses 9 and 10, the kings, the political rulers, will lament because the political authority came from this city. In verses 11 through the first part of verse 17, the merchants will lament because this was the economic center of the world, the new Wall Street of the future. And also the transporters, now a terminology, perhaps the truckers, in verses 17 to 19, the third group, that are now lamenting the destruction of Babylon because all luxury items has now gone up in smoke. And while these three groups are lamenting, kings, businessmen, and transporters, three other groups are rejoicing over the fall of Babylon in verse 20. And these are the saints, the apostles, and the prophets. And verse 21 to 23 provides the totality of Babylon's future destruction. In verse 21, there's the symbol of a millstone. And you throw a millstone into the water, because of its weight, it won't float. It'll go right to the bottom and soak and no longer be visible. That's how Babylon will suddenly disappear. In verses 22 and 23, she'll cease to be a world capital and cease to be an economic center. And in verse 24, again, guilty of killing the prophets and the tribulation saints, and now she pays the penalty for those deeds. So for tomorrow, read ahead to chapters 19 to 22. We'll complete our study, chapters 19 to 22. We've got some minutes for questions. Who's got the first question tonight? Okay, we'll skip the first question. Who's got the second question tonight? Okay.
You mentioned that messengers will be sent from Babylon to notify the Antichrist of its destruction. Is that accommodating language, or do you think that the world will be in such, have gone through such devastation that electronic communication won't be around?
Well, what you can see from our first few days is that, the judgment's coming on the earth. Between two-thirds and three-quarters of the earth is totally annihilated before Armageddon. That includes all of the oil fields and sources of energy. They'll have to resort to all the methods. Also, not only will things on earth destroyed, things in the space and atmosphere also destroyed, and that can include all of the satellites and so on, which have all those detailed communications. So the Bible already mentioned that those things are going to be disappearing, and that's why it may be necessary to go back to all the methods of warfare. Question?
What is an example of political domination?
Say again now?
Of political domination.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah.
It means that he rules the world politically as a dictator, not by being voted in, but he'll be a dictator of the whole world. He'll be an emperor, but he achieves that authority by conquest. Is that clear? There'll be two different political systems. For the first half of the tribulation, the political system is of 10 kings who are co-equal. So these are 10 kings who are ruling it, but that's the political system. Like now we have different political systems. We have, for example, democracies, communists, fascism, all kinds of different political systems, Islamic systems. So there'll be 10 kings that rule the world co-equally. In the second political system, the Antichrist will rule as the sole ruler. All the other kings have their titles, but they're under his authority. So a counterfeit king of kings and lord of lords. That help? Question?
Yes, Arnold, this is from Joshua 1. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, and of course you know what it says. But describe the book of the law. When is it?
Well, the book of the law is the Mosaic law, the five books of Moses. Because the time that with Moses dead, that's the whole Bible at that point. There's no more Bible than the first five books at that stage. And now he must meditate upon the teachings of the law of Moses.
Okay, well, was it something that they held in their hand?
Well, it was a scroll. I mean, all that was with
the Ten Commandments?
No. The law of Moses contains 613 commandments. 613. No, and the word law doesn't refer to the commandments only, it refers to the whole five books. And so and so keep that in mind. But there were commandments given from Genesis through the Abrahamic covenant and so on, and then more to the law of Moses. But the law of the Lord is not 10 commandments. The law of the Lord is 613. Well, to go through Genesis, 11 times it says, now these are the generations of. Mm-hmm. And that phrase refers that there was a continuation of keeping family documents. Mm-hmm. So Moses did not so much actually write Genesis, he compiled 11 different documents. And so the first time you see that phrase is in Genesis chapter 2. So these documents were continued and kept up to date and kept up to date, and Moses had all these documents, he put them together, and that's how Genesis was formed, because he was not a witness to anything in Genesis. He becomes a witness only as the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's what he's a witness to. But that phrase is found in Genesis as continuation of documents. And so, and the documents were scrolls, not books.
Okay, so and these were transported with the children?
Yeah, when the children, when they traveled, they took those documents with them. They kept the family documents. Those were very, very important and precious to Jewish families. Question?
Isaiah 13 and 14 talk about the destruction of Babylon. You said that's in the future. That's never happened in the past. Babylon has been destroyed in the past, though, hasn't it? And how is that?
Well, not destroyed, because it just became a ghost town. Because when Medo-Persia captured Babylon, captured intact. And Osiris appointed Darius to rule over the province of Babylon, and the capital of Babylon became the capital of the province, not the whole empire anymore. And under him were three presidents, one of them was Daniel, so he took the city intact. The only casualty was Cyrus, everybody else basically surrendered. So it never suffered the kind of destruction you see here described here. Medo-Persian Empire began to decline, the city of Babylon became more ghost town. And so at the time you get to the Greek invasion under this Alexander, Babylon doesn't exist anymore.
Will the battle be literally supernatural? Or is it like sword against spear?
Well, initially it'd be sword against... But by whatever weapons they have at that point of time, that's what they will use. With the second coming, it becomes supernatural. But before that, it's all natural. Yeah?
What would you say would be the most important thing besides praying for your families? Because some of them go to different churches, and I get to listen in to what their belief system is. You know, they go by faith, they believe in Christ, and da da da. Whatever, and he said, Mom, you always say that yours is the only church, true church. I said, well, the church is a bunch of believers like us. Uh-huh. The church is just a building, but the true church is believers. So I had to ask, and I want to know, because one day, my mom didn't tell me when you face the Lord. So would you say that just praying and living a life that is an example would be the best?
The best way to do what now?
The best thing to do right now to pray for the families that they will be saved.
Well, we got to go beyond prayer. I think you should pray for the salvation, but ultimately they have to be approached with the gospel and be able to present the gospel presentation. So, without the hearing, there is no faith. So it's more than just praying for them, more than living an example for them. I find the situation in Jewish ministries, because people often tell me, they have Jewish neighbors, and they're reluctant to witness to them, so they just live a Christian life in front of them until they ask questions. And so I asked them, how long have you been living with these neighbors? 5 years, 7 years, 8 years. Have they ever asked you why you're different? No. But you have to come out. In the book Acts and so on, people presented the gospel. So go beyond praying. Find a way to get the gospel to them. That's what you have to do. And if it makes everybody angry, that's all right. The offense of the cross is the offense of the cross. No compromising there. Yeah.
You Jews.
Yeah, 1492 was the very year the Spanish Empire expelled all the Jews.
Yeah.
So it's no accident that that was the same year the New World was discovered.
And you said that you applied it, you said that there's a principle where God always
sees. If one part of the world turns against the Jews, God opens up another part of the world for the Jews to flee to. And so so Spain, then 2 years later, Portugal followed the same, began to expel the Jews and so on. So very quickly, Jews began moving towards the New World and setting up Jewish communities in South America, Central America, and the islands, the Dutch islands, for example, and so on. Question?
I have one more.
Okay.
The route from Jezreel to Jerusalem, you said there are two routes, two main routes.
Uh-huh.
Are there modern roads?
Yeah. There's a modern road along the coastal route and a modern road from the central mountain route. And the central route, of course, the coastal route is mostly four lane, but the central route is mostly one and a half or two lanes going up and down, heavily into what's now the West Bank Arab territory. And because of its various curvatures and so on, it's a lot easier for attackers to hide than attack. Whereas in the coastal plain, there's nowhere to hide. Yeah.
Is the Gaza Strip important to Israel itself or all the other countries? Is it, who owns it, or is it just...
Who owns what now?
The Gaza Strip.
Oh, the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is part of the Promised Land. It's also part of the Promised Land that Jews never even had in biblical times. The Philistines took it, and so on. So for most of the Philistine territory, it's now, these are Jewish cities, except Gaza. Gaza's still an Arab city. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? Okay. Well, biblically, they will rebuild the temple, that's for sure. No construction is happening right now at this point. What you have is three other things happening in preparation for it. You have one group called the Temple Mount Institute that made all of the furnishings for the temple pretty well complete now. A second group is called the group that is known as the Crown of the Priesthood. And they're training the descendants of Aaron to do proper sacrifices. And then you have another group trying to produce the perfect red heifer, which is not a sacrifice, but was used for corpse uncleanness. So before any priest could function, they have to be sprinkled with water mixed with the ashes of the red heifer. So you have three different groups doing three different things in preparation for the temple, but the construction is not yet happening.
So is Aaron's lineage still known?
Yeah. Once, when the temple was destroyed and all of the family records were destroyed, the rabbis issued certain rulings to make sure that the line of Levi maintains its identity. Because for the temple, it doesn't matter who the other tribes are, but it doesn't matter who the Levites are. So Jewish people named Levi, Levinson, Leventhal, Levenberg, or some form of that name, are Levites. But not all Levites could be priests. To be a priest, you have to be a Levite who is a direct descendant of Aaron. So a Jewish people named Cohen, it'll be spelled C-O-H-N, C-O-H-E-N, K-A-H-N, in some form. That's the word for priest. These are direct descendants of Aaron. And those are the ones that are now being trained in the school to do proper sacrificing. Question? Any other questions? Okay.
Different spelling.
Who, you have somebody in mind? Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? Okay, we'll see you for the grand finale tomorrow night.